if we're not delivering a positive social impact from what we're doing, then even if it's made a profit, that's still not a successful development. And I think that is a step change in mindset that we need to see, definitely.
What we're seeing now is a new evolution in terms of development.
When we talk about nature in a very conventional and beauty in a very conventional sense, that can be so limiting.
Hello and welcome to another EG podcast. I'm Damien Wild, Editor-in-Chief of EG. Back in February at Fitzwilliam College, Cambridge, EG staged our latest Peter Wilson lecture. It was nothing less than provocative, challenging, and ultimately, I think, rousing. Delivering it was Dame Fiona Reynolds, Master of Emmanuel College, Cambridge. The former Director General of the National Trust hasn't always been a natural ally to the property industry, and I think it's fair to say that some of those present found her argument that we live in a world where the drive for economic growth is crowding out everything that can't be given a monetary value an uncomfortable one. But after an hour on stage, it was clear that Dame Fiona had won over many of the sceptics present. The question that hung in the air afterwards, though, was this. Did the author of The Fight for Beauty have an army of fresh allies? Or would they, this industry, continue to fail to find space for the things that really matter but money can't buy, including our future? Her words there. To discuss this and how and whether the property industry is changing, I'm joined by three guests in the EG studio. John Moffat is Development Director at Capital & Centric. Ami Kotecha is co-founder of AREP and Managing Director of Amro Living. And Rob Sadler is Head of Office for Cambridge for Savills. Rob, you were there for Dame Fiona's lecture. Were you challenged by what she said? Were you changed?
No, for the simple reason, I think we're already on that path. And certainly the examples that she gave, we were familiar with. And I think what we're seeing now is a new evolution in terms of development. It can't always happen, but if you've got the scale and you've got the means about you in terms of bringing this forward at not just a pace to earn a quick buck, you will see that there is a new wave of developments coming through, both in terms of residential and commercial examples. And she actually picked out a couple that were based around Cambridge, and we're now seeing some larger ones in the outer town markets as well. And actually, those who think that it's an expensive exercise, actually what you find is the value is being recreated and added to those residential properties, so you're actually getting your money back if you can actually plan these things going forward. And at the end of the day, the architecture that we're talking about, and in terms of the master planning, shouldn't cost you that much more money to actually fulfill.
Okay, I'm not sure that quite everyone was so enlightened on the evening. There's a little bit of uncomfortable shuffling in there, and some of those I spoke to afterwards certainly felt challenged by what she said. But the industry is changing. I think there are some good examples of that. As you said, she used some in Cambridge, and there are elsewhere. We'll talk about some perhaps where there is further to go. But when you say that the industry is changing, how recent do you think that change is?
I think certainly since the last recession. And it's in respect of what the market demands now. People are expecting a better quality of living. It's just not just directly about bricks and mortar anymore. It's about what you provide in terms of the amenity offer. It has to be affordable. There needs to be that sort of work living balance as well. So you need to create jobs and integrate those jobs within the communities that you are providing.
Okay.
Which is much easier to do if you've got scale.
Yes, yeah. And Ami, you're working in a sector which is changing and has really accelerated its growth, built to rent, in the last few years. Does it feel different to you?
Going back to your initial point about Dame Edna Reynolds and Fiona Reynolds, and what she said, I think that built to rent is a really good example of a reaction to a market that is ready for change. What it brings, I think, built to rent is a real ability to deliver something extra and additional to just some accommodation for people to live in. And I think that's the gem of the whole thing. So for example, in the developments that we look at, and this is regardless, this is regardless of massive scale. So we could be at a critical mass of between 300 and 400 units. And even within that sort of scale, we see it's totally affordable and actually absolutely imperative to develop in green space and to develop in some ability to enjoy a kind of outdoor living style that is over and above what you would experience if you lived in a Victorian house with a small garden. So I think, yes, we are Built to Rent is rising to that challenge, and it's offering up opportunity to bring in nature in the way that Fiona Reynolds talked about it, but in a more kind of shared community environment.
And I guess it's not just changing in line with the environment. It is a reaction to the environment as well, and meeting a different need and being more responsive as well. Do you think that evolution will continue?
Absolutely. And I think, going back to the point made earlier, I think the more it gets aligned with the positive return on investment, the more it is going to become part of your economic and commercial decision, and it will be there to stay. When you hear staggering statistics like adding 10% green space to an environment where none exists can have up to a 4 degrees Celsius impact on positive impact on temperature creep over 80 years, and those sorts of statistics tell you that we must include this in our commercial cash flows and in the way we look at it and make it a mainstay of how we make decisions.
Okay, thank you. And John, Capital & Centric has a reputation for doing things differently to many other developers. Is that a reaction, and is that a deliberate approach?
Yeah, and I don't think it's necessarily that you have to be philanthropic to kind of take this view of development, that actually good commercial sense and adding the kind of community social impact side of what we do sit hand in hand. So for example, one of the things that we're really focused on is in the regions, a lot of the urban residential development is done through a kind of fractional investor model. And what we see as a result of that is these high velocity communities being created where tenant turnover is really high, and therefore no one has any incentive to actually get to know their next door neighbour. If you go on Rightmove in Manchester, for example, which is where we're based, most of the developments in there say investors only, no owner occupiers allowed. So when we launched Crusader Mill, which was a grade 2 listed mill just behind Piccadilly Station, we flipped that on its head and we said owner occupiers only, no investors allowed. It was probably a brave call at the time, but has proven to be exactly the right thing to do. There is massive untapped demand in the owner-occupier market, but people just... It is a more arduous method of development, but actually, you know, it can yield great financial return. We opened a pop-up sales suite for 6 hours in July 2017, and we sold £7 million worth of apartments, you know, 2 years ahead of PC, to an owner-occupier community. Now, that's great from our side in terms of quantum of sales, but actually from a community creation point of view, it's absolutely critical, because these people are going to put down roots in this area. They're going to make this their home, and we throw parties for all of our owner-occupier community. We continue to do that well ahead of completion. And as a result, we're seeing proper community creation well before the point of completion. And that's really, we think, the way that it should be done. That we've got to take an approach to residential development where we see people being included, and we see community created. Because at the moment, this kind of fractional model, I think it almost isolates and anonymizes tenants rather than the opposite. And for me, that's a concern, particularly, you know, when you look at the statistics around isolation and what that does in terms of mental health. I think really we've got to take a different view of how we create socially sustainable development from a residential perspective.
Okay, and Rob said earlier how much he thought the industry had changed since the last financial crisis. Have you seen that change since you began at Capital & Centric? And do you think the industry is coming round to your way of thinking?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily call it our way of thinking, but I know what you mean. I don't think we own this area.
I didn't mean you had a monopoly
on
it. No. But it is,
I just
thought
I'd clarify.
Thinking, yes.
But I think the position is very different in the regions. I think London is its own market. We're very active in the region. So what I see is not necessarily a development market that has embraced this concept. I think it is increasingly being seen as something that has to be done. But I think people are taking the view that this is, it's almost begrudgingly that, you know, we have to do this now, rather than seeing it as an opportunity to actually create something that is, you know, really special. I have to say, being involved in that process of selling apartments to owner occupiers is a really great experience, and seeing proper community creation occur is, you know, something that's, you know, really fulfilling, but it's also financially a very savvy move as well.
Okay, thank you. And Rob, you were talking about that change that you'd seen in the Cambridge market. John said that perhaps Manchester is different, and maybe this is a London, maybe it's a South East phenomenon. Do you see evidence of that?
I think that, you know, London itself is its own region, and that's the way to look at it. I think that, as I said before, we've seen this coming, and it's a response in terms of the markets. I think for far too long there's been a sort of flight to the bottom in terms of building cheaply, but not necessarily pitching these units at a cheaper price. So actually, you're not really getting good value for money. And I think the point that I was making is that, you know, good architecture and good master planning and bringing amenities into the schemes that you're talking about, and job creation and creating that community spirit, will actually, in the long run, enhance the value of the product that you're building. So it's a win-win. And we're seeing that. And I did mention before that it can be slightly easier if you've got scale, because you are in control of all of the elements. And I think this is the issue that we have, in certainly in terms of the regional markets. You might be involved with a smaller development, 200 to 300 houses, but you may not have that control over the amenities that are being put in place alongside it, or you may not have involvement with the commercial space that sits alongside it. So you are influencing the development, but you're not necessarily controlling it. And I don't want to use that word control in a sort of a negative way. But if what we've seen before, in certainly in some of the larger type developments that are out of town, is that there was a sort of a charge ahead to put in the infrastructure, charging ahead to build houses, because that's actually how you're going to get the return on your investment. But those softer things, in terms of the amenities, et cetera, they're left to last. And actually, they need to be in there up front, and they need to be there day one. And that's where the financial model, you know, can't quite get to grips with that, in terms of putting those amenities in day one, because you're not actually going to get the financial reward to it. But in terms of the outputs, when you bring the residential and you bring those communities together, you know, if you've got that longevity and you're in it for the long haul, you will see the benefits.
Okay. And do you think it makes a difference whether it's a project that is led by build to rent or led by build to sale, or can both apply equally?
I think you have to, there are markets for both. I think the we're seeing a change, certainly, and I'm just talking about Cambridge here, for people looking at the rental market as a sort of a longer term play than they have done in the past. So actually, there is a need to provide both. I think I take John's point. What we don't want to do is be selling large swathes of residential property that could go to owner occupiers that can't afford necessarily to buy into it, and then they're going on off to, for example, the overseas markets, etc., that they're not actually coming to even see the property. And so I think what you're seeing here is a gentle mix of what you need. If you certainly look at the rental markets, and you look at what they've done down at the Olympic Village, and what they've created there, and all the news that we see in the press this week in terms of tenants being allowed to stay on and not be turned out of their property when the landlord decides they want to do that, there is certainly a market for that type of product.
Okay, thank you. And Ami, with so much of this is about, or the success or failure of these projects is determined about whether you do take existing communities with you, not how quickly you can build communities in those places. How do you see, do you see a magic formula for doing that successfully?
I think there are a couple of aspects that are really important. Clearly, early engagement at the local level and making sure that you your new development actually knits well into the local fabric is really key. And we see that as a very key part of the entire kind of process of development. It's about the early communication, and it's about reaching out to the local community and making sure that we've done our research in terms of understanding what it is that we, where are the gaps? I mean, if we are going to come on and bring on new amenity, then we want to service that larger kind of public realm, if you like, and not just keep it as a private amenity necessarily for the new residents. So there is a communication, that there is a need for reaching out, but also I think there is the need to understand for local government to understand that there is a need for them to also play ball in terms of looking at local infrastructure again and encouraging a revival side by side with new developments that come on. Quite rightly, as Rob said, private developers can't do everything, especially when you're limited by your scale and you're not part of the master planning exercise. So there is, I think, an understanding there with private developers that the conversation should not just be the one-way conversation where we are trying to do the placemaking early and do the communication early, but equally local government is being supportive in that communication and opening up channels of communication where they can to encourage that knitting in, if you like.
It sounds like you don't think local authorities do engage in that sort of communication. I think you nodded and shook your head simultaneously then.
They could definitely do more. Often new development is seen as seen for what it is in terms of its urban form rather than its social impact early on, and that can be quite detrimental to what actually happens on the ground and how much you can take on in terms of an understanding from the local population as to what they want. And I think if you're not careful, then it becomes that typical planning run with the NIMBY kind of approach that we have often seen, where everything gets painted negatively. And I think local government does has a part to play in that, in turning that positively and looking at what the economic and social ripple effects can be that the new development bring and creating an engagement, a sort of wider engagement in the community.
Thank you. And John, you talked about the importance of creating new communities, but existing communities, old communities, can feel threatened, can feel displaced by that. So how, while creating new communities, do you ensure that the existing community stays engaged?
Yeah, I think that's a very valid point. I think whatever we do, it's got to sit within the local context properly. It's got to address the local context properly. It's got to engage local people. One of the things that we see going forwards is we want the public to be able to engage with our buildings. Whatever the building is, whatever the use is, in some way, the public need to have an engagement with that building, whether that's a rooftop garden that they can use, whether it's a square, whether they can come in and use the retail or whatever it is. There has to be a route by which the public have an interaction with your asset. Otherwise, you're just plonking a building in an area that has no direct correlation to the people around it. And I think that's particularly pertinent in areas of deprivation. So one of the schemes that we're developing currently is the Littlewood Studios development in Liverpool, which is a film and TV complex. And it's a difficult context. It's an area of deprivation. And we've acknowledged the fact that we can't just bring lots of great jobs and import people into that area to fill the job need. We've got to deal with that in a local basis. So part of what we've done is we've worked with education partners to provide a full FEHE offer on site, and then added to that an outreach program into local schools to go and engage with young kids and enthuse them about the prospect of a job in this industry. they'll then be able to come in, be upskilled, reskilled, and straight into employment on site. And the great thing is that sector particularly offers a really broad range of skill sets. So the kind of social mobility impact of that is fantastic. And as a result of that, we see that we're going to be able to engage with local disengaged young people and ensure that the building isn't just a kind of wealthy enclave in the middle of a disadvantaged area, but actually engages and changes its local surrounding. I think it's absolutely critical.
And an awful fire there, of course, which yes. perhaps highlighted how much it means to the community and the wider community as yeah. well.
I mean, we always knew it was a greatly beloved building and, you know, truly iconic. But the outpouring of kind of grief and kind of the well-wishing that happened immediately after the fire was, it blew us away. I think it just proves, as you say, just how important that asset is to that local community. And, you know, we're fully committed to bringing that back and restoring it and actually delivering something that's going to be even better than, you know, hopefully what was there previously.
Okay, thank you. And Amy there, John touched on the importance of mixed use and different access points to these buildings. Do you think a variety of uses on site is simply the way forward now?
I think so. Taking build to rent as a model and as a way of experimentation is how we look at it. And not only do we look at these spaces as amenity spaces for the residents, but just like John mentioned, I think it's a really important way to connect to the local community. So what we've known for a long time, the concept of, for example, an urban common, where a local community can actually come, utilize, and give back to, and have a responsibility towards that sort of feedback or that sort of closed loop activity, I think generates lots of different access points and creates opportunity not just within the actual building or the scheme, but at its doorstep as well, so to speak, and we look at that sort of engagement very positively. So, for example, in our in one of our schemes, we're looking at the ground floor containing a social enterprise, where we're looking at there is a local local school for less able children and adults, and we are looking at engaging with them to come and see to sort of, you know, give them an ambition that they haven't had before. They study at a school at the school not far from where the scheme is located, but now they have the opportunity to come in potentially and lead a small cafe-like enterprise, which would be totally within their ambit. We'd support it through the management and et cetera in terms of helping them set it up. But it would create an access point and also a real important statement to the community that, you know, this is not just about a private residential block. This is about a way of giving back and engaging.
Okay, and Rob, in somewhere like Cambridge, where space is at an absolute premium, but there is a considerable housing need, I think in the context of this conversation, it's hard not to bring in the green belt here and really identify how you manage that tension, because it gets to the heart of much of what we've been talking about taking communities with you, about planning policy and about delivery at speed, I guess. Is that a potential blocker?
It is a potential blocker, but actually for very good reason. It is there to protect cities and towns, you know, from literally bumping into each other. So it is there, and it must be respected. But
it can be an impediment to having a grown-up conversation about some of the more brownfield parts of the Greenbelt.
I was going to say there are certain areas that you would look at, certainly between the edges of the city and motorways, where, you know, how can it be actually addressed as Greenbelt when you are sandwiched between the built environment and a motorway? So there are certain areas where you could nibble away in terms of the edges and still be right up against some hard roads and those sorts of things. So in terms of Cambridge, for example, there has to be a sort of review over all sorts of aspects in terms of density. You know, we're still only we've got the tallest buildings in Cambridge are only 6-7 stories. you know, you go to Manchester, you're talking 2030. You know, we had a building built last year that's at the dizzy heights of 8 stories. You know, and all of a sudden we've hit the limit.
How was that received in planning?
This is the issue. It took 5 or 6 years to get planning for it. You know, for an 8-story building in an employment zoned area. Whilst we have to look at the green belt, there is still a tremendous amount of scope within the city to look at building up rather than just out.
Okay, and one aspect we've only just touched upon is if we are talking about the future of development, how do we harness cultural ambition and how do we harness creativity? And I guess, John, this industry hasn't always had a great reputation for creativity and perhaps cultural ambition. Is that wrong, or is it something that can only be delivered in partnership with third parties?
I think you're right that it hasn't. And I think that's fair, because I think historically developers haven't really understood the value of culture, and they haven't appreciated necessarily how to engage directly with that industry. I think that is changing, but as I say, I think it's slow, and I think a lot of times what we see, you know, people saying, well, we'll put some meanwhile use in there, as though that's, you know, in itself is enough.
Until we go back to the traditional way of doing things.
Yeah, so. Exactly. And I think just a kind of cursory talking about meanwhile use is not good enough. It's got to be something that, again, is engaging. It can't just be a meanwhile use that is isolating from the community. It's got to, again, engage and draw in the community to the site. I think that's something where we need to see improvements in the way that the development market addresses the kind of cultural sector, definitely.
I guess the first stage is recognising that you're not very good at it. And do you see more engagement with other parties to help inject cultural creativity into places?
Yeah, well, it's definitely got to be done with third party kind of injection of that creative element. We're not good at doing it ourselves necessarily. I think it's got to be done with engagement with the cultural sector, definitely.
And Rob, it's got to be linked to place as well, hasn't it? Cambridge and Manchester, both very culturally rich places, but perhaps in different ways.
Absolutely, and I think it all goes back to the first point in terms of providing that amenity space, whether it's cultural, whether it's sporting, whether it's shopping, or whether it's relaxation. It all needs to be considered, and I said it needs to be considered at scale. Now, if there isn't the opportunity to do that between one or two land ownerships, then there has to be a sort of coming together of developers and parties to try and create that, because I think certainly the examples that we've seen come through as well, and certainly the ones we're dealing with at the moment, it is on the agenda, particularly the cultural element as much as sporting elements and other bits and pieces that go along for us to form that sustainable development. And I think we are seeing this now, and it's developers are reaching out to try and connect into that piece. They can't do it on their own. And certainly we're seeing it through Cambridge, through the universities, through the museums, and looking at what they can actually provide in terms of their developments that ultimately they can justify, because, as I said, it will add value back to the community and the housing that they're providing.
And Ami, if this industry needs allies to fight for beauty, who do you think those allies should be?
God, that's not an easy question to answer, but I think the broad answer would be that the whole gamut has actually changed, and the whole process of development has now become so multidisciplinary. I think that we're not talking about architects and town planners themselves designing these buildings for future use, and I think it's a broad range of stakeholders that we would like to come to the table to give opinions and to provide input as to what they want to see shape the future of these schemes and societies. So I think the broad answer is that we need to have methods of reaching out and speaking to a variety of people, residents. We mentioned Cambridge and Manchester as being very culturally dynamic and rich. I mean, we can't leave London out in that. The need to be heterogeneous in terms of who we reach out to and diverse in terms of who we reach out to is really important. So one of the things I would say, again, harking back to the day, to the evening of the lecture, that one thought that came across to my mind was when we talk about nature in a very conventional and beauty in a very conventional sense, that can be so limiting. My response to that would be, well, you know, would graffiti in the South Bank's area count as beauty? Can we preserve that for its sake because it's meeting the needs of social engagement amongst these skateboarders, for example? So there is the need to reach out to a variety of heterogeneous populations and cultures to give us that, to build in the diversity that we need and the long-term sustainability.
Thank you. And Rob and John, to extend that point, if development and developers are to be fit for purpose in the 21st century, what is the thing that they most need to deliver upon?
Well, Rob? It will evolve. They will evolve and they'll listen to their markets. And I think if you look at the top five house builders, you know, in the UK, they're not all doing terribly well at the moment. And it's the others that are coming through that are providing longer term sustainable developments and actually listening to what, you know, the next generation and we all want in terms of sustainable buildings.
Okay, John?
Yeah, I agree with that point that I think the big five in the kind of suburban housing market are not meeting the actual demand of occupiers, and I think there is a definite need for disruption of that industry, and something that I think, you know, we're definitely keen on being involved in. But yes, I think we've got to developers have got to realise that there is more to development than bricks and mortar. And if we're not delivering a positive social impact from what we're doing, then even if it's made a profit, that's still not a successful development. And I think that is a step change in mindset that we need to see, definitely.
That's a great note to end on. Ami, John and Rob, thank you very much.